Hi folks, Jean here, and welcome to another episode of Have You Ever Read? If you are a regular listener of the show, today's episode is likely to take you all the way out of your comfort zone. Today's episode is about politics. Bear with me, I'm not talking about red versus blue or green or orange or whatever colour your local or national political party represents. I'm talking about the type of politics, or some may say social action, justice or entrepreneurship, that sees us as Christians become the hands and feet of our Father on the earth He created. 2024 is unique. This is the year that will see the single largest number of people vote in national elections around the world than any other time in history. How are we supposed to respond to this as Christians? What can we do to address some of the major global issues facing the world today? Why has the church forgotten that social action goes hand in hand with the Great Commission and the evangelization of the world? All these issues and more are unpacked in today's book by John Stott, Issues Facing Christians Today. Now, this is a deep, thought-provoking, dense but stimulating book. This is a book that engages the mind. If you've ever wondered what Christ meant when he said, "Love the Lord with all your mind," I think you'll get it by the end of this podcast. I sit down for this conversation with Nick Jones, who is the senior editor of Seen and Unseen, the online publication of the Center for Cultural Witness. As you'll hear, it's a fitting choice given his background. Well, I'm going to call it quits for now, but be prepared to be stimulated as you listen to Have You Ever Read? Issues Facing Christians Today by John Stott with Nick Jones. Enjoy! Hi Nick, thanks so much for agreeing to be with us today on Have You Ever Read? Have You Ever Read? Let me say that clearly. So before we dive into the book, can you just introduce yourself to the audience and maybe tell people how we met?
Great, Jean. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm Nick Jones. I'm the senior editor of an online magazine called Seen and Unseen. It's part of a new initiative called the Center for Cultural Witness that's recently got going, and we aim to help cultivate confident Christian voices in the public square who can perhaps point towards some of the unseen in this world as well.
How did we meet?
Great. It's one of those things. My background is as a journalist and writer and communicator. And one of our writers, Chris Wadibia, who is based at Oxford, had mentioned an intriguing conference at the Side Business School, which is part of the university in Oxford, on faith and business. And I remember going along, and it's a great event. And on the program, and the organizers were mentioned, they were up front as well. I think there was one called Jean Kabosami. And through various routes there, I think we got in contact with each other and started to discuss various things about, you know, the world of business and how perhaps we could perhaps write about that topic, as it's very much part of the world that we're in. And then Jean, again, thank you, and I've thanked you before. You wrote a really, really good article for us at Christmas last year. We've been featuring all aspects of Christmas, the theology, the meaning, trying to make Christmas understandable by those perhaps who are outside of Christian faith, but are beginning to lean in and look around the world and ask, is it going to be okay? And you shared a very personal story about a loss, a family loss, and it was very sort of counter to the general tone at Christmas, but it was powerfully, a good story well told. It was great that you not only podcast but you write as well.
Yeah. Thanks, appreciate that. No kind words. So I do want to delve into a little bit about what the Center for Cultural Witness does, and also to talk a little bit about a faith story. But could you tell us about the book that you want to discuss, we're going to discuss today, and why you chose that book?
The book is called Issues Facing Christians Today. And the today it mentions was back in, and if I'm flicking to the front, the first edition, I reckon sometime in the mid 80s, 1984.
Yeah.
And it's by an author called John Stott, who was a Anglican vicar, minister at the All Souls Church in central London, but who also was quite a thinker, as well in his time. And the book was about issues facing Christians then. And the reason I sort of picked it was it's probably still very relevant to the world today, as Christians are facing lots of different issues.
Yeah, definitely. And so just going back, because the way I kind of structure the podcast, as regular listeners will know, is we kind of do a little bit of an intro to the book, but also because we're trying to reflect the whole body of Christ, we want to hear about the stories of the individuals. So could you share a little bit about your faith story?
It's an interesting one, and some of it feeds into this book selection. I'm Scottish, as you can tell from the accent, but my dad's English from a Welsh background. My mum's Scottish. We lived in a new town, which back then were new, but they were basically thousands and thousands of families put together in the brave new world. Some of it perhaps too brave and too architecturally adventurous. Some of it fantastic. We went to schools that had swimming pools. We had play parks. Housing didn't leak. Life was optimistic, but back then. But there was a cloud over so much of this. You know, the great big backdrop to society back then was the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the West. And you know, it's something I think for today's generation to understand. It felt, you know, apocalyptic. It felt a bit like the climate crisis. You know, the world might end, but it felt like it could end next minute thanks to a nuclear missile landing on that. So that was a big issue. You know, politics at the geopolitical level, war, peace were fantastic big issues. I grew up in a family that went to a Baptist church after they grew up. My parents grew up in the Exclusive Brethren, which was a group of Christians who very sincere, but very much felt they were not of the world. They did not take part, did not stand in elections, did not vote. My grandfather was a, you know, people in the family were pacifists.
Okay,
You know,
wow.
their brothers and sisters fought and died in wars, but some of them chose to be pacifists as well. So it was a strange of principled but not political. And as a kid, I remember my dad signed up for a, I think you might call it a Christian mission generically, but it was called Keston College. And what it did was it documented and gathered information about Christians being persecuted in the Soviet Union. These were Baptists that didn't, you know, refuse to sort of register their church, Christians serving the military that refused to carry out certain duties. And this was both a sort of highly emotional story. You know, there are Christians that were, you know, died for their faith, made to stand out in the cold and in prison. And interestingly, the Alexander Navalny story recently brought back very strong memories of some of the conditions and torture and abuse that is perhaps standard Russian state bad behavior, you know, as it were. And I was aware of this, and that's wrong. That's wrong. So, you know, you know, as you get to high school, you start to notice things in the world. The news is happening. We all watch the news then. You know, society would talk about the same things. Amnesty International was a very popular charity. There were local groups supporting prisoners of conscience, and so that kind of always fit. That need for freedom of belief always resonated with me. And it was quite academic. You know, I wasn't a Christian, but I was in a Christian family. But hanging out
Did
with
you
my
go to
great,
church?
yes, yeah.
Okay.
You know, and you would have mission speakers who were, you know, telling stories of the hard life and encounters that they have as well. But it just felt, you know, this was wrong, what was happening to fellow believers with the same brand, the same, you know, Baptists, you know, that the connection was there. And, you know, I became a Christian, was about 16, through a great bunch of friends. And even before that, we would argue about all sorts of things, not just religion and Christianity, but also, you know, politics and life. And it was back to that fear of annihilation. You know, my friends had CND badges. Do you know what CND stands for?
No, I
Campaign
don't.
for nuclear disarmament. It's the peace
Ah,
trident, the
okay.
peace badge.
Right.
And back then, it was a strong political movement. People marched. Pop stars, you supported it. It was worn with sort of serious intent by friends and by teachers. And we had a class at school called Modern Studies. You probably call it politics or civics in America. And we studied all the big issues, politics and society. And this was under a shadow. And you know, near Glasgow, where I grew up, we were less than 40 miles away from the British nuclear deterrent naval base. Boats, submarines that were being loaded with nuclear missiles. You could see the bunkers in the hillside. And, you know, kids being morbid, what happens if a nuclear missile lands in that? You know, war, destruction. And, you know, and interestingly, society, it's interesting how that fear manifests itself. And it's the fallout cloud. Where would the wind blow? And there was a famous book by Raymond Briggs, the illustrator, but when the wind blows, will it blow the nuclear that you waste, you know, the fallout across our houses, you know? And people took it incredibly seriously. You know, friends' dads had plans for bunkers and survive to escape this threat. Others were more like, well, we're all dead. So this world of, you know, a potential apocalypse weighed heavy on all of us.
So what then? So you mentioned that you were 16. It was your group of friends. Were they Baptist as well?
All sorts. Church of Scotland, Presbyterian, some Open Brethren, some independent evangelical churches, and just a good bunch of friends that rolled around and, you know, discussed, chatted, played together, studied together. And, you know, they were just a good
group of friends.
Good friends should be.
So do you remember what it was about the gospel that changed it for you? Because you said you'd grown up in a Christian home. So what was it? Was it their friendship? Was it the debate? Do you remember what exactly put
we used to go to a group called Christian Endeavor. It's a youth group at another church. And the leaders were there were wonderful, patient, kind, enthusiastic, funny, challenging. They saw the potential in children, both sort of spiritual and, you know, general in life. And they organized those fantastic activities. And I remember one, it was about being ambassadors for Christ. Mm-hmm. And you were split into two groups and you had to be sent to the other country to negotiate. You were given your orders. And it was about how to sort of keep your faith without being pressurized on that one. And that appealed to me as politics. But, you know, you realized there were some things worth believing and fighting for or arguing for. But in the end, it came down to the grace, you know, the love, you know, that absolute, you know, sacrifice of Jesus and the love and what that meant. And then you see the behavior in Christians as a result. Mm-hmm. So I think that was what really sort of made me decide.
Wow, interesting. So then going further, how do you think that your upbringing related into how you moved into the Center for Cultural Witness? Because as you said, it's talking of it, the aim is to kind of be a better witness to the world.
Well, it sowed seeds, back to that classroom for modern studies, you know, you couldn't escape the conversations. You know, in the charts, you had Frankie Goes to Hollywood singing Two Tribes Go to War with Reagan and Gorbachev, you know, actors dressed up as them punching each other. Sting, you know, had a song, I Hope the Russians Love Their Children's Too. Fashion, Vivian Westwood was going to number 10 with a No to Nuclear Missiles t-shirt. Christians were marching to peace camp. I was arguing with my friends about deterrence. I was probably, because I had this dislike of the Soviet system for what they were doing, I was like, you know, they can't win, you know. And so I was probably the only person in the class who was like pro-nuclear weapons, because of deterrence on that. So we discussed and we argued, and it was just normal for us to be aware of our culture.
Yeah.
We probably couldn't escape from it, whether we liked it or not, you know. So it weighed heavy on us, and we thought about it, and some of us prayed about it, others argued, some became very political, some studied politics at university. You know, that was very much the norm for us. So it was a febrile time. It just really then leads you into other debates about economics, and it was the time of Thatcherism, massive economic change, particularly in Scotland. People's lives were being changed by forces around them. So that makes you fantastically culturally aware. And so through my life, I was, you know, I'm interested in sort of reading, love reading. I read the newspapers every single day. I watched all the news. I was a news junkie.
Yeah.
I have a school notebook from primary school from 1976. And my school news is not whether the dog ate something or the cat, you know, slept in my bed. It was the Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter election results, which I obviously just watched the news, consumed, and, you know, spat out verbatim. Wow. I think I even drew an election scoreboard for it. So that's the type of kid I was. So despite that, I didn't study that at university, but I was very involved in student politics and debating and media, and worked in a student newspaper and ended up managing that. And that led to a career in journalism and communications.
Okay.
So yeah, that's kind of how the continuity through to the beginning of my career.
Interesting. And it really explains why you've chosen this book, because sitting in this, it really all makes sense now, because I'm coming from a evangelical background where most of my life has been about the gospel as the Great Commission, right? That it's all about salvation of souls. And yes, there are a few people who are called to politics, but really our main desire and aim and focus should be on the evangelism of the world. Mm-hmm. So reading this book really changed that perception for me. So I think that was my major takeaway. Do you want to maybe explain your major takeaway from the book?
Well, I think you've really put your finger on something, because, you know, John Stott, who wrote it, was a evangelical Anglican vicar.
Yeah.
And I was looking at his Wikipedia page, this book isn't mentioned. His other books on the cross, you know, his work on the Lausanne Assembly on evangelism helped define modern Western evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. You know, yet he also took time to write this.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, you know, that you start to, you know, back to my personal situation, my faith, you know, the political world that we're in. The first chapters in the book are, should Christians be involved?
Yes. Yeah.
Can we think straight? Should we impose our views? Alienation, how can we influence this world that was beginning to become secular?
Yeah.
And, you know, that just helped sort me out and say it was legitimate to have a political position for or against nuclear weapons. A just war, a peace, you know, economics, left or right, and not just have a position, but be involved. And I think that was massive. And again, back to, I knew this sort of whole, you know, from my grandparents not taking part in even voting in elections. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of realized that was quite significant.
No, I totally agree. I mean, so just to give the readers some context in terms of how the book is laid out. So it's in four parts. And the first part, as Nick mentioned, is about contextual issues. So that's where John Stott goes through, basically, as Nick said, should Christians really get involved? How should Christians think distinctly? And how should Christians be influential, but at the same time accepting the pluralism of different thought in the world? And what he does really skillfully is he breaks it down and he goes through things theologically. I think I had, because I would say I'm relatively political for a person of my age, what I really enjoyed about it is that he breaks down things through Christian doctrine. So he tells us how we should view our getting involved in politics. And he also defines politics, which I also thought was quite interesting. Yeah. And I think some of the stuff that I had never thought about or put together was the fact that having a better idea of a fuller vision of who God is will cause me as a Christian to act. How did your theology change as a result of reading the book?
With my background, you know, the Brethren can be fantastically sincere, but also fantastically legalistic.
Yeah.
Rules and you know, things like that. And then, you know, the Baptist Church was fairly evangelical. You know, there are aspects of our worship, you know, evangelical worship, that can be very much in the moment or escaping the world and like that one. So I think that rootedness, where are you coming from, where the world, that context, you know, you called that first section the contextual issues.
Yeah,
that's exactly important. You know, that was a big thing for me, that we weren't just escaping from the world and living our own personal holy huddle lives. Yeah. As well, that's always been very important. I think the other thing is this sort of, I think there's references in the book to double listening and triple listening.
Yeah,
you know, listen to the word, listen to the world, and listen to each other.
Yeah,
and that one in particular, given we're in an age of the media, the digital media allows us to talk to everyone, ourselves, shut up and listen. You know, it's probably the best advice you could take through. So I found that fantastically underpinning in a foundational sense, going to university, you know, for engaging in the world of work as well. And it's really interesting. One of Stott's other legacies is he set up the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity,
right,
which still goes today. But about that, the you're taking part in the workplace, bring your, you know, and Mark Green, the director, wrote a great book, Thank God It's Monday. It's not about Sunday.
Wow.
You know, it's about taking your faith into the workplace and likewise taking your faith into your politics and your beliefs and things like that. So that's some of the big changes.
Yeah, I like that point that you brought up, because one of the things that really struck me was when he said, the way he explained, we're in the world but not of the world. And I hadn't really thought of it in that sense, that the church has this kind of dual, there's a paradoxical kind of situation where the church is supposed to be in the world, really contributing, but not of it. And I hadn't thought of it in relation to the church. I think I'd thought of it mostly in relation to how I am, but that actually his point was you can't separate evangelism from social action, and that some of the time the church is kind of hid behind, the, as you mentioned before, escaped and said, we're not supposed to be part of this because we're separate. So we mentioned the contextual issues, but then I didn't actually explain the other three parts of the book. So the other three parts are global issues, social issues, and personal issues. And basically John Stott goes through different things that relate to these issues. So global issues, broadly speaking, he puts these topics under there. So war, environment, human rights, and poverty. And actually, reading this section of the book, for me, it was the, unlike you, who grew up in a time where war was, war was more imminent, the threat of war was more imminent than it is so now. This was the first time that I'd actually worked through what it means for there to be a just war, and having a position on around indiscriminate bombing, or as you said, nuclear disarmament. What does it mean for it to be a deterrent? What does it mean for a war to be controlled? So again, what I thought that he did brilliantly about with these major issues was bring in the theological aspect. So it wasn't a case of, and we're finding so many people are just choosing sides in wars in this current time based on what they think God might say using a few verses from the Bible. And what I think I took away from there was having a holistic theological approach to some of these major issues. Another one that really touched me was around the environment, which I'm not a climate change denier, as it were, but I'm also not a freedom fighter for the climate. But I think reading this book, I went away thinking, I haven't bought a car yet, and I was seriously considering, should I or should I not buy a car? I'm a Londoner, I don't necessarily need a car. And there's a stat that he mentioned where he said that people from the UK use 30 times more energy than people from Bangladesh. So that really made me think about waste and greed and gluttony, like things I hadn't really thought about in relation to these major world issues. So did you come across anything that maybe changed your behavior as you've read this?
Yeah, I think you absolutely nail it there with, you know, he helps us think theologically. And just going back to my current job with the centre, we want to take the best of theology out of 100,000 word books that are probably read by theologians, written by theologians for other theologians, and help people apply it to the world. And that's what John Stott role modelled. And that thinking, you know, for example, with the environmental discussions, ecological debate, I think he calls it at one point, he was spot on the money. You know, he was 30 years ahead of common culture on this, you know, move towards understanding the environment and the consequences of our wasteful behaviors, you know, on that. And again, giving a not just it's a bad thing to do, but giving a very, very good reason. You know, it is God's creation and we are stewards. You know, and that sort of, you know, unveiling those unseen angles is really important. Of those ones, you know, I think he scores really well. You know, I mean, interestingly, with the nuclear threat and war, very topical. It's come back. You know, we're thinking about just war for the first time in 20, 30 years. The environment, you know, as I said, he's on the money on that one. The section on poverty or North-South economic inequalities. I don't know if I can prove it directly, but, you know, you had some massive changes in society about 10, 15 years later. The whole Jubilee 2000 campaign to cancel third world debt. That, you know, the development, 0.7% of GDP going towards development, you know, a lot of Christian campaigners were involved in making that happen from Bono downwards. And, you know, as a legacy, I think that's quite a strong one. And even with human rights and that discussion about human worth, all these current culture war debates, you know, about identity, you know, are often seen through a rights framework. So again, he was looking at that. And again, human rights often, you know, are often inspired by Christian values. You know, when you do the archaeology, you know, on it. So, you know, we are still actively involved in these topics. But I'd probably say the nuclear one at the time was very helpful. But, you know, in terms of the legacy and that sort of economic inequalities, poverty. You know, I've just edited an article on the Sustainable Development Goals.
Right.
That'll go live in a couple of days. You know. Yeah. It's still topical. We still need to think it through.
Yeah, no, you're right. Because even as I read it, it's something that we had, like, they come up a lot in business school, as I did the MBA. But actually reading it and hearing him talk about them from with a Christian lens, it really changed me. And it's actually made me think, okay, so what am I doing to help solve some of these major problems? And not as a human being or as a human, but as a Christian, like, what impact am I making? And I think one of the things he really drew out for me that was really helpful was this idea that we as Christians shouldn't allow the secularization of some of these topics that I think mostly said that in the human rights section, that without God, there is no moral right or wrong. And so how do you then define what it means to have a human right if there's no right or wrong? And all the time when these rights are discussed, we as Christians sit back and just take it as a given, especially when we're from the Western world. But then we forget that actually the Western principles are built on a Christian worldview or mind, worldview. And so it's always just to kind of, even when I'm engaging with these topics, to always bring up that the Christian lens, I guess.
And it's, you know, again, just going back to the day job with the Centre for Cultural Witness, there's a lovely quote from C.S. Lewis that Bishop Graham Tomlin, our founder, uses. I can't quite remember. Basically, you know, the proof of Christ and Christianity is the light he sheds in the world that allows us to see more clearly.
Well,
you know, we're not perhaps, you know, he's behind us shedding, that's showing the light, and we're seeing ahead. You know, we can't see him, but we know his impact and presence. On it. The human rights one is really fascinating because, you know, the topic of dignity and worth, and we are all made in God's image, underpicks so much. There's another chapter on the what Stott calls the multiracial dream. You know, multiculturalism, I guess that term's morphed into. And, you know, Galatians chapter 3, verse 23, neither Jew nor Greek. And that you know, we are all made in the image of God. You know, the Catholic teaching and you know, on that influences so much. And it's you know, as we search for identity currently in all the different ways and label each other by identities, I think that's increasingly important for society, and not just in the personal identity and that side of things. I think in the world of work, and again, Stott's got a chapter on work and unemployment, you know, as AI radically transforms everything, you know, we get a lot of our dignity from what we do.
Yeah.
It defines who we are. There's going to be a really big change coming up.
Yeah.
And there's a very strong trend, you know, trend of thought in the Catholic social teaching around about dignity. And something a lot of unions, you know, fought for recognition of work in Victorian times, and it's quite quaint. Stott's got a chapter called Industrial Relations.
Yes,
which is probably the most 1970s phrase ever.
I think I've got the most recent edition. I think that chapter is now called Business Relationships.
Interesting enough, you know, but back to this exchange of value between you know, workers and the business. You know, that's suddenly relevant again with AI, and you know, the attention economy we live in, and the power of the algorithm to harvest our attention.
Yeah, they actually added another chapter, not written by Scott, because I think he had passed by the time came out, called The New Biotechnology. So it's really up to date, and you're right. I mean, it's really interesting to see. Somebody would, I guess, looking at it from an evangelical wing or lens, I'd probably say this book is quite prophetic in that it actually is so relevant now. The thing, I mean, moving on to, as I talk about this, thinking about this, like the challenges with reading the book, apart from the fact that there's a lot in it, one of the things that is a bit problematic is the dates are a bit old, right? Because the
they're historic. They were vaguely relevant from at my time, but you look back now, he's quoting studies from the 60s and the 70s. Whoa.
So in this edition that I'm reading, I think it's the fifth edition, or it's the fourth edition. Fourth edition, published in 2006. So it doesn't take into account the recent developments in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But leaving those historical facts aside, the rest of the content is so relevant, it's unbelievable. I mean, the stuff that he's talking about, gender studies, about marriage and divorce, we have abortion and euthanasia, and then same-sex relationships. So all stuff that Christians around the world are currently grappling with. And I just find that so interesting. And I find it interesting that it's a book so political, but at the same time, you can see or feel the influence of the Holy Spirit throughout it. Because some of the stuff he's saying, he can only become from the Holy Spirit.
Exactly. And it's just so foundational. And I don't know whether when you were studying, you often that course you're meant to be paying a bit attention to, and, you know, you've maybe not paid as much attention. Yeah. And then you go, in my day, you went to the library.
I still do that.
You find a book that saves you. It's all there in one thing, you know, and it shows you which way is up.
Yeah.
And which way's forward? It yeah. orientates you, and you, suddenly the subject's opened up. So
yeah.
you know, I think it is quite, you know, prophetic's a great word to use about it. You know, and he is revered and enjoy. You know, it's still, you know, he influenced a lot of people, a lot of stories that that come back to him, on so many different levels.
And just, I mentioned briefly some of the challenges. Do you think there's anything that somebody reading this book would find challenging? Maybe someone from a different denomination, or where they would maybe think, I don't really agree with that, or this is...
Well, I think Stott had a humility and grace. So hopefully it's not too polemic. He is literally a dead white man. You know, and there are ways of analysing that and looking for power structures. But I think the way he constructs a chapter, he will read around an issue, he will quote academics and theologians, you know, various sides. So you may not agree with everything he's saying, but you are being taken through the issues and taught to think. And I think that's really important. And at least people, there's an old technique in sort of argument and debate about, you know, in order to be an effective opponent, you need to understand your opponent's debate so well that you can make the case for them.
Yeah.
So if someone that wasn't a Christian, that did not agree with the Christian worldview, they would read this and they would understand us better. They may not still agree with us, but they would understand where we're coming from, what motivates us, and why we take, you know, why these positions are taken.
Yeah.
So I think that would be the way of doing it, you know, looking at it. It's interesting, you mentioned, you know, Iraq and some of the developments sort of post 2006, and I was trying to think of what things did he miss out on. You mentioned the biotech there, terrorism, you know, and, you know, particularly religiously inspired terrorism,
okay.
you know, as well, extremism.
So sorry to interrupt you, Nick, but I think he does in this
in
the fourth edition. He does actually talk about terrorism.
Oh, yeah. I'll take that one. So in secular political studies, that's been the big thing in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, so okay. See, he's good. I told you.
Yeah. and he goes into all types of terrorism, not just what the focus in the UK or in the West is. Islamist terrorism, but he does mention that there has been some Christian terrorism, and yeah, looks at it through those lenses. Yeah, so it's really
he's good.
Yeah, he's good. But though, I would say I made a mistake when I was reading this book, and I said it to you earlier. Normally when I come into the podcast, I read the whole book when I'm speaking to a guest, because I want it to be authentic, right?
Yeah.
But the mistake I made with this book is actually, I don't think this is a type of book that you can read page to page, cover to cover. I feel it's more an anthology type book where if you have an issue around, you want to understand same-sex relationships and a Christian viewpoint on it, you pick up the book and you just find the chapter. So I would say if you're not somebody who is familiar with deep academic or theological arguments, you may need to kind of take your time with it. It's not something that you can read in a night, basically.
No. I don't think I ever read it in a night. You know, it's more of a textbook, reference book.
It's a reference book, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And but the point is, you will take it off the bookshelf every couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, and think, well, wonder how that would work, you know. So
I think more frequently, actually, nowadays.
And interestingly, just on that sort of accessibility angle, at the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity, I think it was back in 21, they did a series of podcasts of revisiting the book.
Okay.
As well, so that might be a way for folks to, if they want to sort of sample it or get into it that way as well. I think they did four
okay,
podcasts about that.
So I'll put links to those in the show notes for the listeners. Yeah. That's really helpful, and I'll listen to it myself, actually. So before we round up, actually, I want to ask you, was there anything you personally struggled with when you were reading the book?
I think there's some personal relations in marriage. You know, when it came out, you know, in my teens.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was all a bit, you know, down the line. Yeah, you know, as we're later in life. So, you know, I was loving the chapters on the global issues. You know, I wasn't working, so industrial relations, business, that was all, you know, hypothetical.
Okay.
It's not a context that I had experience of, aside from just watching the news. So
Okay.
I guess those were perhaps the less well thumbed chapters of the book.
Okay. So I didn't realize this is what you meant, that you actually first read this when you were a teenager. Oh, wow. That's
I
really
remember
good.
some going out into this, my goodness, a Christian's written a book about politics. Grab with both hands,
So that's really interesting. And I guess, I mean, I did say before we round up, but I just realized for people who are in politics as a career and they're Christians, and by politics, I guess I mean anything around social action, I think this is a must purchase book. I would say one of the things that he said that was really helpful and insightful to me was that we as Christians, I guess maybe he was referring mostly to the church, should be led by principles and not just politics, and not programs that entice division. And I think,
My goodness, I mean, those are prophetic words for today with social media. I mean, he was on the money.
So I guess if you're struggling with how to be a good Christian in the field of politics, because I think we spoke mostly from the aspect of a Christian who's just living a regular life and isn't really engaged as much. But if you're somebody who is active in politics or social action, this is a must-have book for you. There was one quote in the book that I really liked, that it was a professor, can't remember where they were from, maybe at Harvard or Stanford, and they were saying that their department, they're a professor of social entrepreneurship, and they said that their department only exists because the church has stopped doing its work. And I found that to be, yeah, it made me stumped to actually reflect and think, wow, that, yeah. So again, it's just to say to those people that your work is necessary and needed, and if you're struggling, this is definitely a tool for you to tap into. So before we close, Nick, because this is a podcast about reading, do you have any tips on your reading habits for the listeners?
Just see reading as a time of joy, a blessing, and just those moments of, cuddling up with a good book or strap hanging on the train, holding a book awkwardly, but you're doing it because you still want to read it and finish it. I'm still a paper guy. I remember writing articles about Kindles and e-readers, when they were coming out as new technology. And yeah, it works for some people. If you can balance your Kindle as well, or your e-reader, or your phone, you seize those moments, treasure them, get into the book, and do that.
And do you have any favorite Christian authors that you want to recommend to the audience?
Philip Yancey. Yeah, it's just such a fantastic storyteller. Those ones stick in the mind. On that, I do this out of duty, but also because he is a great writer. It's my boss, Graham Tomlin, who this ended. He can write, and it's always great to read the take. And he's got a bit of he's got a little bit of flair, and a bit of twinkle. You can hear the twinkle in his eye, hear or see the twinkle in his eye when you read. Just to mix lots of metaphors, and that's great. That's really good. And just talking of stories, can I just go away from that subject of authors, but just tell you a little story about it that relates back to the book. In the acknowledgements in the book, John Stott thanks someone called Martin, who was one of his research associates in the book, and Martin helped start the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity with John Stott. And fast forward to a pub in London. And I'm introduced to a woman called Sarah. And we bonded over a mutual love of politics and realized we're both Christians. And we got married. And Sarah is the daughter of Martin. And Sarah remembers, being taken into work to meet, and playing around in the office, while her dad talked to John Stott and worked with him as well. So, yes, this book is politics and work and the world out there, but it's also personal.
That's a really
So
interesting,
I
really nice
didn't know
story.
that at the time. I probably didn't read the acknowledgements, but it's been quite good to get to the to see that through.
Oh, that's a really nice story. Okay, and my last question is your top three Christian book recommendations.
Oh gosh, this the new edition of it. on that one, I Philip Yancey, what's amazing about Grace? It's just, it's fantastic. You know, just again, just for giving you a lift, a joy, an inspiration, is really good. It's not a sort of straightforward Christian book, but there's a book by a famous American author, novelist called Norman MacLean. And his famous book is called When a River Runs Through It. And it was made into a film in the 90s or 2000s. And it's about him growing up in Montana and his brother and his relationship with his father. Fast forward to the 80s, and Norman MacLean knows he's dying. And he grew up in this place where the rivers are beautiful, but also the forest fires were terrible. And he was marked by a dreadful disaster that occurred. To fight the forest fires, the National Park Service fire jumpers would jump out planes, parachute down with their tools, dig trenches, try and put out fires to stop the fire spreading. And in 1949, when he was a young man, 12 of these fire jumpers died in a dreadful fire that turned into sort of fire tornado. It jumped the valley and it killed 12 of them. You know, they couldn't outrun it. They tried to run uphill to escape the fire and they couldn't outrun it. And, you know, at the age of 80-something, he goes back to the site of this disaster and meditates and contemplates the death of these young men. It's him remembering his youth. There's 12 white crosses. And, you know, he starts to meditate on Golgotha the crucifixion.
Yeah.
And the story. And he also goes into the science of fire. How did this, you know, fire behave, the physics? Why could they never beat it?
Yeah.
And he writes, because he's such a good writer, he just writes beautifully. You wouldn't think, you're reading a description of fire science. You know, he doesn't use that many equations. But he writes beautifully, and there is a pinnacle in the book, a sort of moment that's perhaps like Mozart's Requiem, you know, the finale, the music. And he describes the wise old leader of the group, who basically knelt down, lit a match, set fire to the area around him. He walked into the fire and he saved his life.
Oh, wow.
Because the fire that he set burnt his skin, but it consumed the oxygen.
Oh.
So when the firestorm raced to him and passed him, there was nothing for it to burn.
Oh.
And that was a lower temperature, and that was enough for him to survive.
Okay.
You know, the imagery of Christ's sacrifice.
It
comes through in so many different levels in that book. So that's a book I probably reread every decade.
Okay. What's it called again?
Young Men in Fire.
Young
Norman
Men in Fire.
MacLean.
Okay.
So as a meditation on sort of sacrifice, it's fantastic.
Wow, that sounds really deep. Great. So I'll put all those books on the show notes and on my website. And so before we sign off, Nick, so you mentioned the Center for Cultural Witness and you've mentioned Seen and Unseen. How can the listeners get in contact with you, find out more about both things?
Yeah, www.seenandunseen.com for the magazine website. We have podcasts Reenchanting, Seen and Unseen Aloud, which is the articles narrated. We have links to those from the site. And the Center for Cultural Witness is at culturalwitness.org. We'd love people to read, discuss, share the articles, and get in touch, you know, as well, if it's helped inspire them.
Brilliant. And I'll put all those links in the show notes and on my website. So thanks again, so much for your time, Nick. It's been great. And I guess we'll speak soon. Thanks.
Great, Jean. It's been a pleasure. Cheers then. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. Well, I hope that's given you food for thought and made you consider not only reading the book, but also how you can be the Lord's hands and feet in the challenges we all face today. As ever, the links to all the books Nick recommended and to issues facing Christians today will be in the show notes and on my website, which is www.jeancabasomi.com/podcast. That's www.jeancabasomi.com/podcast. I will also add the links to the Center for Cultural Witness, Seen and Unseen, and the article I wrote for the magazine, which Nick referenced. If you like this episode, please rate and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps the algorithms get the podcast into the hands of other potential listeners. Well, that's all from me. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate you taking your time out of your busy schedule just to hear me. Well, and to hear about some great books. God willing, I'll be back in your ears next month. Until then, keep reading and seeking the Lord. God bless. Bye.